The normal conference is over. I'm sitting here at Pier 23. I'm with Alan St. Pierre, and we're going to talk about the conference. What did we accomplish?
Well, like we did last year, we put together the largest pro-marijuana conference in the United States. We brought together about 555, 560 people from the medical marijuana community, the recreational community, and the hemp community. It's the only conference that puts everybody into one tent. It is a tremendous sense of community. When you see that you're in the majority regarding polling, voting data, and culture, and yet one feels like an oppressed minority, and you come together, you feel so incredibly liberated.
This following program is dedicated to the city and people of San Francisco, who may not know it, but they are beautiful, and so is their city. This is a very personal song, so if the viewer cannot understand it, particularly those of you who are European residents, save up all your bread and fly Translove Airways to San Francisco, USA. Then maybe you'll understand the song. It will be worth it. If not for the sake of this song, but for the sake of your own peace of mind.
Welcome to this special edition of Cultural Baggage.
Strobe lights beam, create streams. Walls move, minds do too. On a warm San Franciscan night. Old child, young child, feel alright. On a warm San Franciscan night. San Francisco.
This is a special Cultural Baggage. You've heard from Alan St. Pierre. Additional guests will include Nadine Strawson of the ACLU, Richard Cowan, Dr. Tom O'Connell, Gary Stork and Jackie Rickert, Woody Harrelson, and Jack Herr. And our special guest for the evening, the District Attorney of San Francisco, Terrence Allen. And to tell us about tomorrow's scheduled rally, we will have Rosanna Ruiz and Tirso Ponce.
Welcome to Cultural Baggage. I am Dean Becker. We hope to have Terrence Hallinan with us here in a little bit. There's been a bit of a situation. I've been talking to his assistant, and we'll see if we can't get him in a bit later. I want to first just kind of give a report of the happenings of the last week. The National Normal Convention in San Francisco was a grand success. A lot of people sharing great information, making progress together towards, you know, ending this jihad on our own people, especially for those who smoke marijuana, and even more particularly those who smoke it for medical purposes. I tell you what, let's just go ahead and begin with one of the speakers from the conference, Nadine Strawson of the ACLU.
And the war on drugs has warped judicial neutrality and constitutional law. The judge made drug exceptions to every precious constitutional right, including rights that would seem to have very little to do with drugs, such as the First Amendment's guarantee of religious liberty. When your religious beliefs happen to involve currently illegal substances, such as the sacramental use of peyote in the Native American church, then the U.S. Supreme Court reads the religious freedom guarantee out of the Constitution for everyone, rather than respect your right to use peyote in sacred ceremonies. I'm, of course, referring to a 1990 Supreme Court decision, which was so devastating to religious freedom generally that it prompted Congress to pass a law attempting to correct the damage whose name says it all, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Sadly, the Supreme Court struck down that law, so religious freedom remains one of the many constitutional rights that have become casualties of the war on drugs. Since that dreadful date of September 11, 2001, our government has been waging yet another war that has become a war on civil liberties, the so-called war on terrorism. Tragically, though, too many vaunted anti-terrorism measures, like too many vaunted anti-drug measures, do not make us more safe. They only make us less free.
Again, that's Nadine Strawson of the ACLU. You have to stop and think about it, that we have now coalesced members from many organizations. I spoke with Ron Krickenberger
works for, at the top echelon of the Libertarian Party. I spoke with people from across the country, in fact, from around the world. I had a great discussion with Senator Pierre-Claude Nolan of Canada, and he's the gentleman who headed who helped write the report that came out of Canada asking that marijuana basically be legalized, regulated for distribution to adults. And we hope to have him on again as a guest here soon. In fact, I think maybe he wants to come to Texas and straighten us heathens out a bit. He's getting a bit upset with what we're doing here. Now, you stop and think about it here. Here's a report came out of the Santa Cruz Sentinel. This is from yesterday. It says, medical pot lawsuit may witness success. And it says, a lawsuit filed this week over medical marijuana growing in Santa Cruz contains fascinating legal arguments. The issue is far more than the one often cited, states' rights. That argument has never seemed more powerful to us. Perhaps it's because of memories of the civil rights battles of the late 50s and early 60s. Back then, segregationists argued that state law should trump federal law and that segregation should be allowed because individual states wanted it. Now, Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy didn't agree, and two generations later, we praise both men for working to extend federal protection to people of all races. The lawsuit filed this week on behalf of medical marijuana users takes on the federal government, but the issues behind the lawsuit go far beyond a simple states' rights argument. Santa Clara University law professor Gerald Uhlman is one of several attorneys representing the plaintiffs, and he explains some of the facets of the case that will make this lawsuit fascinating to follow as it makes its way through the judicial system. The first instance, the Women's Alliance for Medical Marijuana does not transport any products across state line and can't involve the federal government's control of interstate commerce. Second point, the criminal penalties for WAM, the Women's Area Medical Marijuana Alliance, co-founders Michael and Valerie Corral, are illegal because they were deputized by the City Cruz City Council. And more important, that the drug seizures violate a patient's right to control the circumstances of their own deaths. And in this instance, the medical argument is the strongest one in the suit. Terminal patients are using marijuana to control pain and in some cases restore their appetite. Why federal drug agents would expend this much energy to deny relief to terminal patients is beyond us. Marijuana is probably less damaging to these patients than a number of other medications that they're taking. As Uhlman pointed out, terminal patients aren't taking marijuana as alternative medicine. In fact, the marijuana helps them cope with the pain and discomfort of such treatment as radiation and chemotherapy. The federal government has argued that the patients could be taken advantage of by those touting marijuana or other such so-called treatments as Latrelle. But Uhlman pointed out that patients don't use marijuana as a replacement for any other treatment. And an increasing number of medical doctors are suggesting that some patients can get relief from a medicinal form of marijuana. We understand and support laws that control the use of marijuana by the general public. Our society really doesn't need one more legal drug. But to withhold marijuana from patients who are suffering is the worst kind of folly. It's not only a bad idea, it actually hurts people. Now, there's a diverse discourse that comes forward in these conventions, and here's one that hits on a particularly glaring point, something that I think, you know, people in all organizations, be they peace movement or whatever, should pay attention to.
George W. Bush and suppression of medical cannabis is killing vastly more people and causing vastly more human suffering than even Saddam Hussein could in his worst days. And this is something that the cannabis movement and the peace movement and progressive people every place have to address. People in the who are protesting and being in favor of doing something about poverty in the third world, if they aren't addressing medical cannabis, they are ignoring something that has an enormous impact on millions of people. And a lot of them think, I can't talk about cannabis because I'm too serious. Well, if they're too serious to, they can't talk about mass murder, then they have their priorities all screwed up.
If you've been listening to the 420 Drug War News this week, you've heard us do interviews with Sean Heller and other folks. And in particular, we had on Monday an interview with Dennis Perrone. I think this is the first interview he's given in a while. And the good news is for him, coming out of Utah, is that now the charges against him appear that they're going to be dismissed.
Dennis Perone, the pot I had is legal in California. I grew it. I didn't buy it. I didn't sell it. It's mine. And one of the country's biggest proponents of using marijuana for medical reasons is off the hook after a Cedar City judge ruled the pot was illegally seized. Dennis Perone, who successfully led the campaign to get marijuana legalized as a medicine in California, has been fighting a prosecution in Utah after he was arrested for possessing a pound of pot. In a written ruling issued by 5th District Judge Philip Eves, evidence taken from the Cedar City motel room occupied by Dennis Perone and two of his traveling companions cannot be used against them. Dennis Perone again, I'm glad the Constitution is still alive. I'm looking forward to hanging out in Utah. I hope that someday we can legalize medical marijuana in Utah. Perone had previously lost his argument that a prescription from a California doctor gave him the legal right to have the drug, and there's no indication the judge's decision reflects a person's right to use marijuana for medical purposes. Rather, the ruling cites unlawful search and seizure, which is prohibited under the Fourth Amendment. The Iron County attorney says he can either appeal the judge's decision to a higher court or dismiss the charges, and that decision is expected within a month. You talk to people in California, you see them in action out there, and you see people that are working hard to restore the freedoms that should be ours all across America. And what they do for you and me. They're brave souls. I respect them for it. And I think we should all take a moment to ponder just exactly what it is they're doing out there. They're fighting a federal bureaucracy with millions upon millions of dollars, and they're doing it with courage. And I respect all of them for that. Let's go ahead and run this one more talking point from our good friend. I should mention that last report, as you're probably well aware, was from Richard Cowan of MarijuanaNews.com, a wonderful commentator, and I want to thank him for his interview as well. But let's go to Tom O'Connell.
I think a lot of what's being discussed on both sides of the drug policy issue, and specifically both sides of the medical marijuana issue, are discussions that are conducted in ignorance. By that, I mean that neither side has command of the facts, and most people are operating on speculation and assumptions based on personal experience.
Well, we've got an opportunity in California here to gather facts, because they have a medical marijuana initiative that was passed in 96 and is unique in that it's the most open-ended. It gives the physician the most discretion in terms of the conditions or symptoms for which he can recommend marijuana. The programs in other states that have got them are highly restrictive in that they involve central lists monitored by the police, or restrictive lists of diagnoses or conditions so that only a few patients can qualify. In California, as I say, it's open-ended. Unfortunately, the feds have been terrorizing both doctors and patients by their well-known sweeps and arrests and recently federal trials of activists. So I'm not sure how long this access to patients for information is going to be preserved.
The American Public Health Association, the oldest and largest organization of public health professionals in the world, passed a resolution in 1995 urging lawmakers to make marijuana legally available as a therapeutic agent. Their members represent more than 50,000 people and have been influencing policies and setting priorities in public health since 1872. AFA, their name, pointed out that cannabis, marijuana, has been used medicinally for centuries, and cannabis products were widely prescribed by physicians in the United States until 1937. Marijuana prohibition began with the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937 under false claims despite disagreeing testimony from the AMA's representative. AFA concluded that cannabis marijuana was wrongfully placed in Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act in 1970, depriving patients of its therapeutic potential. To continue, the foremost U.S. medical journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, editorialized on January 30, 1997, quote, a federal policy that prohibits physicians from alleviating suffering by prescribing marijuana for seriously ill patients is misguided, heavy-handed, and inhumane, end quote. Now again, in 1995 and in 1998, The Lancet, which is arguably the world's leading medical journal, editorialized in favor of legalized marijuana for even recreational use, saying, based on the medical evidence available,
moderate indulgence in cannabis has little ill effect on health. Sooner or later, politicians will have to stop running scared and address the evidence. Cannabis per se is not a hazard to society, but driving it further underground may well be. And then lastly, I'd like to say Great Britain addressed the issue in 1998 when the Select Committee on Science and Technology issued cannabis, the scientific and medical evidence. Lord Perry of Walton, chairman of the inquiry, said, "We have seen enough evidence to convince us that a doctor might legitimately want to prescribe cannabis to relieve pain or the symptoms of multiple sclerosis, and that the criminal law ought not to stand in the way." Folks, we're going to take a quick break here. I'm going to bring some friends in from tomorrow's Texans rally for treatment over incarceration for drug offenders with Rosanna Ruiz and help me with your name here, bud. Tirso Ponce?
Tirso Ponce, yes, sir.
Well, close enough, huh?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Steve, help us get a cord working here, bud. Oh, never mind. I got it. All right.
There.
Okay. Now, if you would, please, tell me who you are. We'll start with you, Rosanna, and...
I need a mic.
Oh, shit. Okay. All right. Rosanna, please, tell us who you are and why you're here.
My name is Rosanna Ruiz. I'm a recovering addict and a two-time ex-offender. I've got 8 years and 7.5 months clean. I'm a big miracle, one of God's miracles. Since I've been out, I got my master's in social work, and I'm a licensed chemical dependency counselor. I created a project for ex-offender assistance and reintegration at the Mayor's Citizens Assistance Office. I'm the program director of the Lieutenant's House, which is a residential transitional treatment center. I'm also the I'm a TDCJ volunteer. I'm a very active volunteer. I've been going back into the prisons for the last 4.5 years. I go every week, once, sometimes twice. And I really believe in treatment because it saved my life. I've been incarcerated 14 times in the Harris County Jail. I've been to prison 2 times. And the last trip I went to prison, at the end of my sentence, I went to the Safe P program, which is a long-term intense substance abuse program in TDCJ, and I've been clean ever since. So I believe in treatment.
All right. Thank you, Rosanna. And Ponce, Tirso, I'm sorry, Tirso, tell us who you are and why you're here.
My name is Tirso Ponce, and I work with AMA. It's the Advancement Association for Mexican Americans. I work with troubled teens. I work at Casa Phoenix, and I also work at AMA House, for a shelter for homeless children.
I want to tell both of you that, first, thank you for coming in, and secondarily, thank you again for the work you do. It's very admirable that you would commit some of your life and your ongoing efforts to helping others to get through what for many of us is a stumbling block, a phase of our life that for some is a dabbling with drugs, and for others is almost a lifelong thing.
Right.
There's going to be an event tomorrow at the Power Center. Mm-hmm. It's at 12401 South Post Oak. I think we already played the promo a couple of times. We really want you folks to come out. It's important that we let our government, that we let the media, and therefore the government, know that we care about this issue. You will be speaking tomorrow, Tirso, at this event?
Yes, sir, I will.
Would you care to tell us some of the other people that are going to be there that will be joining in the event?
Well, there's the president of the NAACP of Texas, Gary Bledsoe, and there's Ernest Gibbons, who is the CEO of Riverside General Hospital. We have Reverend Robert Jefferson, the Houston Ministers Against Crime, Orlando Montavo, clinical director of Casa Phoenix, where I work. Mm-hmm. Good man.
Yes.
My mother will be speaking tomorrow. Michael Robinson, director, Riverside of General Hospital Residential Treatment Program, and Yolanda Smith, executive director of the NAACP of Houston. Also, Dwight Stewart, principal economics, Stewart Research Group.
Yeah, and I realize that part of the situation at this point in time, especially, well, it's not just the state of Texas, it's this whole nation, it's every state in the nation is having a budget crunch, has losing so much money, so much tax, and other income, that they're having to find better ways of running this drug war, if you will.
I've talked with both of you. I mean, personally, I think 90% of the people that are out there using should be treated just like we would anybody using alcohol. There are people out there that, my gosh, fall off the edge. Even the alcohol or the cocaine or the heroin can eat them up, can destroy their lives, and we need to give all those people treatment.
I agree.
You say that you've been in TDC twice. I thank God that I never made it that far. I've been arrested 13 times. Most times was for being drunk with drugs in my pocket. You know, that's what usually got me in trouble. And you stop and think about it. We were hoping to have Terrence Hallinan on, and we still may. I don't know yet at this point. But out in California, they have what they call Proposition 36, whereby those arrested for minor amounts of drugs are given treatment the first time. It's an automatic system that's built in that they go through the system and you know, go for the, I guess, the urine tests and so forth and stay under court supervision and try to bring their life back under control. Yeah, here in Harris County, we are the Gulag state, or the Gulag city of the Gulag state. We send, what does this document say? 70%? Let me look at this again. 77% of all drug offenders in Harris County are for less than a gram. And if you don't know what that is, folks, that's like a little packet of sugar. Usually this, what they're talking about is the corner of an empty bag that, you know, the police happened to find on the floor. And tell us about your experience. Are people learning not to do drugs? There's drugs in the prisons, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. You can get anything you want in prison. As a matter of fact, I got clean in prison. I was using in the county jail, and I was using in prison. And I got clean on September 6, 1994, in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. I made a decision. I got tired. They sent me to this long-term treatment program at that point, and I've been clean ever since, and I'm real grateful. But, you know, the prisons are full of people that are in there for drug charges, and the majority of them are black and next are Hispanics. And it's just outrageous, the disproportionate numbers of minorities that are being incarcerated compared to their numbers in the general population. And that proposition in California, I agree 100% with that. The first time somebody gets convicted of a possession charge, possession of a controlled substance, I think they should go to treatment. Because prison doesn't do anything to rehabilitate a drug addict. In fact, all it did for me is I learned more tricks of the trade and how to be a better criminal and how to get over even more. That's what I learned.
Right. It's such a shame that, right, we send them for an intense course on violent criminality for most of these guys. They come out in great shape and ready to go to work hurting somebody. You know, it's kind of sad. Tirzo, I hesitate to dwell on, you know, if you've been in prison or not. Let me ask you this. Your associates, your friends that you've grown up with, and et cetera, some, I'm sure, have gone to prison. It seems to be too prevalent these days. Could you talk about some of those people and, you know, what they were like before they went and what they were like when they came out of prison?
Well, my experience is this. Prison makes you a better criminal.
Yeah.
A way better criminal. You have the opportunity to build on your body, and makes you run faster. You're physically fit. You come out, and you think you can take on the world. I have many, many friends that are in prison. They get no type of education on, you know, their addiction. They have no sense of. They come out thinking that they want to, you know, get back to where they started, and that's, you know, 80% of the people that come out. They really don't think about rehabilitation at all. They just think about starting where they left off. There is no kind of education in there that could actually help or benefit these people. I got lucky. I went, before I got in trouble with serious trouble, I went to treatment. Even though I tried to play the system. I wasn't a drug addict or an alcoholic. I went there to play the system. And then I got educated in treatment on what it is that the effects of drugs can do, such as cocaine, heroin, and all the other things that I was into. And that's what made me want to stop, the education, the educating the mind on the outcome of what could possibly happen to you if you continue this type of life. I've seen many fall, and it is a sad thing because most of the time it's because they're not educated.
Right. I I hesitate to throw a blanket over any situation, but we certainly aren't doing ourselves any good with more than 2 million Americans in prison. It's some of those people are going to become violent and pay us back well more than we've inflicted on them. It's kind of like terrorism almost. I want to take just a quick little break here. Let's go ahead and run that number 7, Steve.
You mentioned earlier Jim and Cheryl Miller, and they're unable to be out here at this normal conference, but let's send them a little message via the radio. What would you like to say to them today?
I'd like to say congratulations, Jim and Cheryl, for winning the Peter McWilliams Award for the Advancement of Medical Marijuana. You and the Mike and Valerie Corral, both you and Cheryl and Mike and Valerie Corral, there are no more deserving people to get this award. And Jim and Cheryl in particularly, you guys are a powerhouse. If people knew what a patient and a caregiver slash loving husband can do, they'd be amazed. Two people in grassroots activism, we can change the laws, you know, and people can do it themselves. We have the power.
Jackie, would you like to send a message to Jim and Cheryl?
I am so proud of both of them. They go to the ultimate lengths to show people exactly what is going on. I have never seen a more loving team in my life. So I think it just kind of goes to show that if one or two or three or four people can do it, if you get together, just look what can happen if we all get out there and say, hey, this is what's real. This is what's not, and this is what has to change, and it has to be now, not next year. Like Cheryl said, it's been an awful long time. We love you. Jim and Cheryl, we totally love you. I was very honored to be there so that Gary and I could pick up the award on your behalf. Just touching, it was like we knew you were both there.
Okay, that was Gary Stork and Jackie Rickert, who accepted the Peter McWilliams Medical Marijuana Award on the behalf of Jim and Cheryl Miller, who were unable to be there, along with Mike and Valerie Corral, who shared in that award this year, and both deservedly so. I want to congratulate them. We're here talking with Rosanna Ruiz and Teresa Ponce about treatment, about drug education, about a better way. And I during the break there, I talked to both of them, and they're both telling me education is the key. And I would agree that many of the harms of the drug war and of the drugs themselves could be eliminated by just educating people with the truth. Would you like to address that point, Rosanna, the truth?
Yeah, the truth is the war on drugs is not working. You know, and education is the key to a lot of things. People need to be educated about addiction. That, you know, for example, I was an addict before I was a criminal, but I was incarcerated a lot of times. You know, a lot of people commit offenses to get their drugs when what they need is treatment so they can get to the root of the problem, so they can learn how to stop using drugs and live life on life's terms. I think it's very effective for people that have been there, done that, to go back into the prison system and work with the kids on the streets and the ex-offenders out here and share their experiences. People that have been there, done that, and doing something different today, something positive, they tend to listen a lot more to those kind of people. It's a very effective education tool.
Thank you, Rosanna. Tirzo, before I get to you on this point, I want to go ahead and alert the listeners out there. We will be taking your calls. Our number here, 713-526-5738. We'll be glad to talk about the San Francisco conference or treatment, not incarceration, or just anything you might want to discuss in regards to the drug war. Tirzo, tell me again, you were talking about the education. I know that's a strong point to you. Why is it that the DARE information is not working? What do you know about the DARE education?
It's bubblegum, in other words. It's not telling the whole truth, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And my opinion is government surrendered this war a long time ago. As long as there's a demand, there will always be a supply. And it's because people are not educated. Not educated on the outcome of what an X pill can do to you. One time, one person, and that's it. It depends on your body. Each individual is different. And if we can educate people and say, hey, this might be, he can pop it maybe 6 or 7 times and not have an effect, and one person can pop it once and die, we have to get that message out there. We have to show them, you know, what the bottom is, and have, as the lady said, have people that have been down this road educate other people, because that's the only way they will listen. Kids are not going to listen to some old guy who, you know, seems to be in his 50s and out of tune of what's going on. But if some guy fresh out of prison, 20-some years old, and he's dedicated to his work and to helping kids, and he comes in there with a very powerful message, kids will tune in. If they can relate, they will tune in.
You're absolutely right. Folks, please consider getting up. It's not early. It starts at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, the Texans Rally for Treatment Over Incarceration for Drug Offenders. And it's easy to get to. It's at 12401 South Post Oak, right down there at South Main, at the Power Center. And I urge you to please attend. It's it should be very not entertaining necessarily, educational. And it should be, perhaps there's going to be some singing, I think, as well. And it'll be a chance to meet with like-minded folks who want to make this change. You two work within the community. Are there not many people who want to see this change occur?
Of course there are. There are a lot of people that want to see this change occur because they know that what we're doing is not working and has not been working. Our prisons are filled with drug offenders or drug-related crimes when what the people need is help for their problem, treatment. Incarceration, it doesn't, like I said earlier, it doesn't rehabilitate anyone. The sad thing is, with these budget cuts going on, they're cutting programs and services in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. And that's the last thing that they should cut. Four of the SAFE-P programs, that stands for Substance Abuse Felony Punishment Facility, of which I'm a product of that and been clean ever since. Four of the SAFE-P programs will be gone this August, and they're going to cut more of the programs. It's real unfortunate to me because these programs are really making a difference in people's lives. They could save a lot more money if they would stop incarcerating people that are on technical violations, and they keep them locked up for years on a violation when they haven't committed a new offense. They could save billions, millions of dollars like that. You know, but they're taking money out of programs and services, and that's where the difference lies. People being educated on the disease of addiction, people being educated, the public being educated. You know, this addiction affects families, communities, and all of society, and it's a devastating disease, and we've got to find something that's going to work.
Yes, we do. Well, we're starting to get some callers. I tell you what, Steve, let's go ahead and take Kevin on line two. Kevin, can you hear us? Hello, Kevin.
Yes. Hello.
Go ahead, sir.
I was wondering about some medicinal marijuana.
Yes, sir. What could we tell you?
My understanding was there was a drug called Marinol.
Marinol is a pill form. It's suspended where the THC is suspended in sesame oil. And you swallow it. It has a super coating on it. It takes about a half hour to an hour to dissolve. And then it gives you a sudden dose of THC, which is, it's equivalent to a barbiturate or something. Whereas with marijuana, you can titrate the dose, take 1, 2, 3 hits, whatever is required to alleviate the pain or the symptoms. And stop and consider, if you would, Kevin, that when somebody's undergoing chemotherapy or otherwise has nausea, the last thing they want to do is throw another pill into their stomach so they can swallow more pills. The medical marijuana is able to alleviate the nausea so that the other pills can stay down.
I understand that. I was just curious. I was wondering. I knew this was available.
Yes, sir, it is. It's made by pharmaceutical companies. It costs about $8 a pill. And, why should people be forced to pay $1,500 a month to swallow their other pills. It makes no sense. Did we answer your question there, Kevin?
Yes.
Okay, sir. We thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Steve, let's go to Teresa on line... where are we at here?
One.
Okay, Teresa, line one. Are you with us, Teresa? Okay, all right, let's go to Richard Lake on three. Richard.
Hi, Dean.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm well, my friend. How are you this evening?
Recovering from that conference in San Francisco.
It takes a couple of days to heal up, but it was sure fun.
Oh, yes. meeting all the friends, old friends and new friends.
Yes, indeed.
Learning so much. I really appreciate you getting some sound bites from the conference on the air.
Well, we got a few more to go, too. I know it was great. I have 50 more. We're going to do as many shows. We can do another three shows with just the sound bites I got. Wonderful stuff from everybody out there. It was a great conference.
That's something that when folks have a chance, especially if they're activists, it's great to get to conferences. There's a Drug Policy Alliance conference out in New Jersey in the fall. I hope to make it. Don't know if I will, but I'm going to try and be there. Don't know where Normal's going to do their conference next year, but I do think a lot of folks like San Francisco.
Well, they'll get me back if they have it in San Francisco, I'll tell you that. I've never had such a great time. Richard, as you know, I slept with a rabbit out there, actually, and it was just really fine, to be honest with you. It wasn't bad.
Wake up with a rabbit something on you?
Yeah, the rabbit was in bed with me. I'm not going further with the story. But,
okay.
It was a San Francisco tale, I'll tell you that. Richard, you're in Michigan, am I right?
Yes.
Michigan. What is the medical marijuana status in Michigan?
Not good, not recognized at all. About the only improvement we've had recently in state law is that... they've squished the mandatory minimums, which,
budget crunch is forcing that,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yes, exactly.
Now, but
there is some efforts. Certain cities are called charter cities and have a right to make their own local laws. That's why Ann Arbor has this $50 fine for pot smoking. And on Hash Bash Day, you can see people... smoking off the campus, which is state land, but in the city, in public, like at local restaurants and whatever, that sort of condone that. Out on the front porch with the police car rolling by. So there's going to be some efforts made to this year, as I understand it, to pass medical marijuana ordinances in some of these cities in the state that have the right to do that as the charter cities. How well that'll all go remains to be seen, but it's something that some of the Normal chapter folks and folks from the Drug Policy Forum of Michigan and others are working on. So that's about it happening in Michigan.
Well, here in Texas, of course, we have no referendums available. We do have sheer willpower in Austin, which is making a difference there. And we're going to see if we can't get some people in Houston to stand up for justice and, dealing with reality. We're working with the mayor's office and the city council a bit and even talking to some of the police officer associations, because it's going to take a groundswell of... people throughout government to make a difference. It can't be just one guy standing up and, declaring the emperor has no clothes.
Oh, yes. And every little bit helps. People think, well, so we get a city like Detroit or Ann Arbor making a change. But every time we make a change at a local level, that has influence on the politicians whose voters are in that district. It sends them a clear signal. Clear up the chain to our Congress critters. So the more of that we can do, the better. I noticed at the conference that there's certainly people supporting John Gilmore and others saying we need to get into the states that haven't done medical cannabis initiatives and pass them there, because that's the one sure thing that we know, that between 70% and 80% in any state is the way the vote would go on a reasonable, well-designed initiative. Yes, some of the initiatives may not be everything that every patient wants, but here the issue is that it's really not going to change until it changes at the federal level completely, because the DEA can go after patients and have been going after them for a plant. But the issue is to get the Congress critters to understand that their states, that's what the people want, so that eventually we can bring down these atrocious federal laws.
I hear you, Richard. We got to do it. Now, I appreciate the call. We got a couple other callers here, and we're going to have to move on. But I hope to see you soon, buddy, maybe at that that next conference.
Okay.
All right, Richard.
Good night.
Good night, sir. Okay, for those who, you know, I don't know how to put this. When I was at the conference, Woody Harrelson came on stage, and he asked everybody not to film. And he didn't say anything about audio taping. So I left my camera on and just didn't point it at him. And I was thinking, well, should I play it on the air? And then I said, well, what would Larry Flint do? So I figured, here it is.
What we really know about Woody, and what is so important to all of us, is that Woody has been the single most outspoken advocate for marijuana and hemp in America. Please welcome Woody Harrelson.
So I guess now is as good a time as any. I decided to quit smoking marijuana. Then I realized, hey, I'm not a quitter. Rehab's for quitters. That's why I'm here with you tonight. I can remember my mom sitting in the kitchen, and she's got her coffee and cigarette first thing in the morning, you know, just to get the engines going. And I can remember her saying to me, now, son, if I ever find out you smoke marijuana, it'll just kill me. I mean, to this day, I have a very serious problem with the government that doesn't want you to smoke something because it makes you feel euphoric. Why should euphoria be a bad thing? I mean, I'm the first to admit that, of course, you can get addicted. You know? Not me, but probably some of you could be addicted. The real issue is consensual crimes, the victimless crimes, that anything you're doing that doesn't hurt someone else or somehow hurt their property should be A-OK. I mean, what does it mean to live in a free country? And if... And if, in fact, we're in a free country, don't you think we should be able to do what we want to do as long as we aren't hurting anybody else? All I can say is keep fighting the good fight. Power to the peaceful. Thank you all.
Okay, let's say drug prohibition does support terrorism.
And murder.
And murder.
Torture.
And torture.
Corruption. Bribery.
And whatever.
What's your point?
Change the law.
I gotcha. Make it cheap. More available everywhere, like soda or cheesy puffs.
Exactly.
Cocaine at the playground, crack stands at the laundromat, heroin at the mini mart, like that.
Face it, old man. That's what we've got now.
Okay, that was in response to the government's latest mini mart ad. You might have seen it on TV. We just changed the last couple of words, and it makes more sense when we say it, I promise you. Folks, you were talking about education and so forth, and Theodore, tell us again, who do you work for, and what are you going to be telling the folks at the rally tomorrow?
I work for AMA, the Advancement Association for Mexican Americans. And then tomorrow I will be speaking on behalf of how that program has educated me into not going into the bottomless pit.
The bottomless pit. I've seen it. I didn't quite make it to the bottom, but I know what you're talking about, my friend. And you tell us again who you work for, Rosanna.
I work for the Mayor's Citizens Assistance Office. I have a project for ex-offender assistance and reintegration. I'm also the program director at the Lieutenant's House, which is a residential transitional treatment facility. And I'm an active TDCJ volunteer. I go back into the prisons and work with the prison inmates on a weekly basis.
Tell us about that, the interaction in the prisons. What do you do within the prison?
It's a huge part of my life. I love giving back. I go in to share my experience, strength, and hope with others. All of those negative life experiences that I have, I now use them in a positive way to help somebody else. And back to the education piece that Ponce was talking about, you know, if we educate people on the consequences of addiction and where it can lead, there are so many consequences aside from just criminality and getting locked up and losing wives, husbands, children, families. There are other consequences that are really, really serious as well. For example, if you're a drug offender, you cannot get food stamps. If you're a drug offender and only a drug offender, you can't get a grant to go to college. But you can do any other kind of a crime and get a grant.
Treason, if you'll, anything.
Anything. You can kill somebody, rape somebody, and get a grant to go to college. But if you're a drug offender, you cannot. And I think, you know, what if my, what if I wasn't fortunate enough to have parents that were able to help pay for my education? You know, where would I be now? I wouldn't have a master's degree. I wouldn't be doing a lot of the things that I'm doing today without that education. Because of my background, now I have the experience on the streets, and I also have the credentials. Something else I want to say.
Rosanna, let's go ahead and...
Okay.
She just dropped off. I kept her too long. Teresa, I'm sorry. I was just coming to you. Go ahead.
I also wanted to mention to everybody that's out there listening, it's real important to get involved politically, to contact your state legislators, the state representatives and senators, and let them know how important it is to keep the treatment programs in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Not the treatment programs, the educational programs. I mean, that's where all the cuts are going. And those are the things that can help people to turn their lives around and give people, you know, something different when they go back out into society. And so please contact your legislators and write them, call them, go up to Austin and let them know, please keep the treatment programs.
I want to ask you something here. Have you guys been following the Tulia drug sting, the 38 black people arrested
right
up there by the one officer, Tom Coleman? Well, it seems this guy has now been indicted. He ran a controversial drug sting in Tulia 4 years ago, and he was indicted on charges of lying under oath. Now, you know, I think many times the terrible tragedies, the addiction, the fall into this bottomless pit involves arrest. It involves losing, you were talking about losing possessions, family, hope. And, you know, it is the, in my opinion, the draconian methods of the police department that helps push people further down. Like you talked about, you were a user and then later you became a criminal.
Exactly.
And it is through that interaction or being encompassed by the law that destroys the life, that sends people, you know, thinking that, I don't know, the pit looks better than what they've got. I don't know. It's a terrible situation.
You know, I had no idea that there were going to be so many serious consequences attached to my addiction. Nobody ever taught me, nobody ever educated me on all the potential consequences of using drugs. You know, Dilaudids, crack, and things like that. I just wasn't aware of all the consequences. Had I known all the things that I would lose, and I'm not just talking of material things, I'm talking about the things that are more important, like self-respect and self-esteem and opportunities. There are some doors that will always be closed for me because I'm an ex-offender. And I think that that is very unjust, because people do turn their lives around and people do change. And I think people need an opportunity to prove themselves, an opportunity to get a decent job, because I've been clean 8.5 years. I'm doing something totally different than I used to do. I'm a very productive contributing member of society today. And there are a lot more people like me out here. And I want to encourage anyone that's listening that's caught up in your addiction, there's hope. There is so much hope. But you have to reach out and ask for some help.
That's it. For the young kids out there, you know, we talk about education. Where could they begin to get that education and perhaps stay away from the edge of that pit? I mean, what would you tell the young kids out there, 14, 15, 16 years old?
Well, that most of the stuff that they see on TV is BS.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think that you have to start by letting them know that not all these rappers and rock stars and movie stars, that's not how it is. You know, that's what they adore. That's what they see. That's what they want. And drugs comes with that. Heavy drugs. If you can educate them on the outcome, and if you can just get one, that'd be enough.
Yeah.
But you have to start early.
You do.
And this DARE program, yeah, they talk with kids and they try to get parents involved, but it's very bubblegum. You have to be very graphic, very
That's right.
raw, very real. If you are very raw and real and very graphic, if you hit a nerve, then you've done your job, whether it's cold and ugly, but it's the truth.
Right. And when, from what I understand, that when they compare marijuana with heroin, that they're both as addictive, et cetera, they're setting the kids on the wrong track.
My opinion, yes, they are setting the kids on the wrong track.
I want to add to what he said about the bubblegum tactics that they use. You know, Ponce's right on. Do not sugarcoat this thing, because it's real ugly. So why dress it up and try to make it look prettier than what it is? You know, there is cold, hard realities out there. A lot of people don't want to know the real truth and what's really happening out there. But people need to open their eyes and be aware of the horrors of addiction and everything that goes along with it. And, I just believe that being real and raw, like he said, is, you know, the way that you might turn some people away from it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We're going to do one more tape here. I want folks to hear from Jack Herrera.
I have very few idols in the world, but Jack Herrera is one of them. And I guess a lot of us are wearing hip clothes to this day, because this gentleman right here wrote The Emperor Wears No Clothes and started reading that and saying, hold it, there's an alternative.
The author of The Emperor Wears No Clothes, Jack Herrera.
You know I have a stroke, but I'm getting better at talking, and I will talk your head off. And each time I talk, my doctor says I'm getting better and better and better. So
the last time I did an initiative in Alaska, I was going to go and tell everybody all over the country for 4 months, will meet me on the punch page in the television, and they will see a hemp story they never seen before. Everything they want to know about hemp, marijuana, hemp. If you don't look for hemp, you will go to hell. And we will go up there and win this election.
Yes, the emperor himself, that was Jack Herrera. Jack did have a stroke a couple of years ago. He's bouncing back. He looks better than last year, and he's going to be up there in Alaska, ramming that election down their throats. We're running out of time here, folks. I want to give my two in-studio guests one more chance to, kind of brief you on what they would like to see, what changes they'd like to see made to our drug policy. Rosanna, go ahead first.
I wanted to say that treatment works, prison doesn't. That's the theme of this rally that we're having tomorrow at the Power Center. I encourage everybody to please come out. I couldn't begin to talk about all the changes that need to be made on the war on drugs in a minute, but just please come out to the rally. Treatment works, prison doesn't for addiction.
It's at 11 o'clock tomorrow, Power Center, 12401 South Post Oak at South Main.
Please come.
Dearsall, go ahead, sir.
For the people that are educating, please hold no punches.
Right.
Show these kids at a very early age the outcome, the rawness of the situation. Sometimes it works. And hopefully, though just them sometimes is really what counts. If we can reach one, that's all that matters. Education, I can't stress it enough.
You're absolutely right. We can save people from the pitfalls. I want to thank you both for being here. Mr. Hallinan, I'm sure you'll alert us to when you can come visit us, because, folks, we're looking for you, bud. We'll set that up here and soon. We've got one more track. This is from next week's guest. Her name is Debbie Jeffries, and she lives in the state of California. And through the advice of her doctors, she now gives medical marijuana to her 8-year-old son.
My son has mental illness. He's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, intermittent explosive disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, name it, you know, the whole gamut of mental illness.
Yes.
And he's been through every medication that there's, you know, been prescribed for him, every combination, and he has been in and out of residential facilities. I had explored medical marijuana. It's been used for years and years for mental disorder. And I had a doctor recommend it for Jeffrey. Within a half hour of ingesting his first part of a muffin that had marijuana in it, he was a new child. Within a half hour after ingesting his muffin, his grip loosened, which was kind of odd. He's always real tense, real serious. And I looked over at him, merging into a different lane of traffic, and I said, "Hey, dude, what's up?" And he says, "Mom," he just got this glow about him. He says, "My head is not noisy. I feel happy." Before, I thought I had the spawn of Satan. I say that loosely, but seriously, life was hell for all of us.
She and her has written a book, Jeffrey's Journey, which chronicles the events of fighting the state, first to keep her son, second to medicate him, and then third to, bring the medications to school to actually have it given to him there. Folks, I invite you to tune in next week. Glenn Urbach will be here with The Other Side. And in 2 weeks, our guest will be Debbie Jeffries. And we'll talk about medical marijuana again. We'll have a lot more interviews from the Normal Conference from great folks. And we hope you'll join us at that time. And good night. Thank all the guests who joined us tonight. This is Dean Becker for Steve Nolan, Tammy, and Cheryl saying thank you for joining us on tonight's Cultural Baggage Special Edition on the Normal Conference. Join us in 2 weeks. We're going to do it again.